the oddest couple since Felix and Oscar, Harry and Rob. Today on Uncommon Knowledge, Harry Shearer and Rob Long, Hollywood buddies who disagree about everything. Shooting in Beverly Hills, Uncommon Knowledge, now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. Be sure to visit us on our website, by the way, at hoover.org/UK or on Facebook at facebook.com/UNC Knowledge. Facebook.com/UNC Knowledge. Born in Los Angeles, the author, musician, and comedian Harry Shearer has been an actor since he began appearing as a child on the Jack Benny program. Floorwalker, oh, floorwalker.
Now, wait a minute.
I was the Frank Nelson.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Oh, great.
But I wasn't. I didn't appear that as that.
Actually, though, as
you guys have really nailed the web demo, by the way. Yeah, they're going to eat this up.
All right, stop. Okay. Mr. Shearer's film credits include Abbott and Costello Go to Mars, The Robe, and A Mighty Wind, and the cult classic This Is Spinal Tap. Host of the weekly Santa Monica radio program Le Show, Mr. Shearer is probably best known for The Simpsons, on which he provides the voices for characters including Mr. Burns, Waylon Smithers, and Principal Skinner. In the mid-1980s, Rob Long moved from the Northeast to Los Angeles to enroll in the writing program in the UCLA Film School. Just a few months later, his scripts had so impressed Hollywood that he was hired to produce the final three seasons of one of the most successful sitcoms in the history of television, Cheers.
You killed it.
At the time, Mr. Long was...
We laid it to rest.
24. He was 24. I'm trying to make you look.
I know, good. I'm sorry.
Mr. Long has remained at the top of the television industry ever since his newest comedy, Sullivan and Son, in which he serves as executive producer, premiered on TBS this summer. Whenever Mr. Shearer discusses politics, he sounds like a Hollywood liberal. Whenever his friend Mr. Long discusses politics or on Ricochet.com and National Review writes about the subject, he sounds like a committed conservative. There are those who have their doubts about that as well.
No, everyone agrees he should be committed. Thank you for the setup.
All right, segment one, the two of us. Politics, politics matters to both of you intensely. How do you remain friends, Rob?
We're not really.
I just pretend he's either Mary Madeline or James Carville.
Let's say both. I also don't think Harry's a Hollywood liberal. I am definitely a rhino, but he's not a Hollywood liberal. Harry's sort of a free spirit. So we agree on at least 30%.
Yeah.
We may disagree about the ultimate outcome of it, but Harry's sort of like, you're an iconoclast in many ways. I mean, you're not a fan of the president.
I am not.
I'm not a fan of the president.
How did you meet, by the way? Give me the... We have
a mutual friend.
Right.
Who was writing with me on Cheers, named Tom Leopold, very funny man. And he and Harry did a lot of projects together. And then as weird, you know, coincidence would have it, I moved in... about two blocks away from your house.
Yes.
And then I got a puppy, and I was walking my puppy
We tried home. To get a restraining order, but...
It didn't work.
Didn't work.
I was walking my puppy home one day, and Harry and his then new wife, Judith, stopped. And she was a little homesick. She just moved from the UK. Not Uncommon Knowledge, but the UK. And they wanted to know if there were any puppies available. And there's one other puppy available from the litter. And so we had brother dogs for 10 years.
Cohiba was brother to your dog.
Victor.
To Victor.
And now we have sister dogs. Illy is the sister to Doris. So we're bonded in a canine way.
Exactly right. We're like canine in-laws.
Okay.
Or step-parents or something.
Yeah. Yeah. And so when did you discover that he's more or less conservative? I mean, how does it work in this town? You meet somebody, you have friends
in this town.
Yeah.
I'm not... You think you're going to learn something about Hollywood by talking to us? He can barely get work here, and I'm working in London. So what do you want? You ought to be talking to, you know, Brad or Warren or somebody. How it worked is we were neighbors, and we'd walk the dogs and talk and talk about everything. And, you know,
soon politics enough, comes up sooner or later?
I don't know, but I mean, Harry's never been shy about his opinions, nor have I. So I think we would just talk about, but I think the difference is that if you have a sense of humor, then there's always something to laugh at. And you're honest, there's always something to laugh at. So.
And we would tease each other about, you know, what we assumed to be the other person's beliefs or who had to defend what.
Right.
As it turns out, I think Rob has stayed more where he was when I met him than I have. I've definitely moved away from any sense that... I mean, I was making fun of Bill Clinton all during the Clinton administration, but I think I was on my radio show, but I think I waived at that point my usual stance, which is assume the worst about everybody. And so I was late to the party on that, assuming that the Monica Lewinsky stuff was really true. I was having him concoct alternate explanations, like she was in to do colon cleansing on him or something like that. You know, mm-hmm. That was his explanation to Carville in one of the sketches on my show. Yeah, she's just doing that. But anyway,
pause for a minute while we purge that image.
Purge that thought. Yeah, right. Speaking of purge, well,
there is an image of it.
There
by
is,
the way.
Yeah, I'm sure there is.
I generated that as well. Anyway, yeah.
Please. So you started out. Is it fair to say, a little crude maybe, but it's fair to say you started out as a liberal and are now more or less libertarian?
No.
How would you describe
yourself? No, I don't think I choose to adhere to any particular philosophy, because I don't think any of them, I think all of them have been found wanting.
So you think of yourself, what, as sort of the court jester to the world? Just
it's well, that's what the huge revolving sign says over my house. So.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Dangerous anti-American.
So I have to take credit for that. I paid for it.
Think carefully for a moment.
Think locally?
Act globally.
Act globally, yeah. Think carefully.
What is the worst political mistake of all the opinions you've known Rob to hold? What's the one that most irked you or that you consider the most stubbornly, persistently mistaken?
And all of them. You can't say all of them.
I can't?
Yeah, you can't.
No, well, that would be hard for me because I really don't listen when Rob talks. I just wait for the breath.
That's right. And which doesn't come.
No. it's an actor's approach, you know, blah, 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 my turn.
right.
Rob, Harry's worst mistake, his worst political error. See, now Rob actually has. Rob has a list. Rob has a list. Rob has a list.
He's such a good listener.
It was showing up at an Arianna Huffington for Governor fundraiser.
As a friend.
Yes. Well, you were on the dais.
Yes.
So friendship.
Don't be glad of it.
Friendship trumps politics?
Sometimes.
Are you one of these E.M. Forster? Wasn't that the famous E.M. Forster quotation? If I had a choice, I hope I would much. I hope I would sooner betray my country than betray a friend.
Yeah,
friendship comes above politics in your order of priorities?
I think friendship, you know, let me put it this way. When friends betray friends, I think it's far more profound even than, you know, you can think of reasons why people betray a political system or a government, and you might not be able to justify it, but you can understand it. When friends betray friends, it strikes a chord that I'm saying this because I'm watching this happen very close to me right now. It's so deep and so psychologically searing. I think it's on a whole other order.
Yeah, but you had no trouble betraying Arianna.
I admire her. I admire her.
Her do you admire?
I admire the fact that she built this thing, this Huffington Post.
Can you say that
without the tell?
The nose, yeah.
I can't do it without the tell, Harry. If I could do that, then I would I'd be a lot richer.
Yeah. So she built a giant Arianna business. When she was conservative in Washington, right? You became friends with her when she was conservative.
Me too.
That's right.
Yeah, I became friends with her when she was conservative.
I admire the business she grew. I think that's pretty amazing. She started something. That's pretty great. I mean, in terms of the politics, I find the politics kind of ludicrous, but I understand. When I take her at face value, she changed her mind. It's all right. You're allowed to do that.
You remain friends with her?
Well, yeah. I mean, if I saw her, I'd be happy. I haven't seen her in years, but yeah.
She exists on a somewhat different plane from
If politics is more important to you than it is to Harry. Is that fair?
I don't think so.
Ideology is more important to him than it is to me.
Is it?
I think.
Probably. Yeah. Probably. But I would only say this is that
he lets his ideology do his thinking for him.
Oh, yeah. I consult. I have an app. I have a talking points.
Yeah.
I think what we both share is the ability to laugh at our own side or people who have our own beliefs, and the ability to find the sort of the humor in their incredible weaknesses and foibles and mistakes and pomposities and all sorts of things. And I think that's really valuable. That's the one thing I think we've lost in general. And I put that blame for that on the left. Because the left got extremely pious, and they happened to be in charge of the entire media at the time. So now you can't. There's not one person on television who has a critical view of standard left-wing nonsense. Not one. They all kowtow because they have no sense of humor.
All right. Segment two.
Pow.
Segment.
I'm not on television.
Segment two. Segment two. The intellectual history of Mr. Robert Long. Rob,
you told me at one point.
Wait, you said intellectual history?
That's right. Yeah. Well, just go with it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
You told me once that you became a conservative during your first year in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. In fact, I made notes and I've dug them up. Quote, I'm quoting you, a friend gave me a copy of Modern Times. Modern Times is the history of the 20th century by the conservative British historian Paul Johnson.
By the way, when you dug this up, were there any Indian artifacts nearby?
It's for sale in the lobby.
Okay.
I kept reading one, quoting Rob again, I kept reading one thing after another that they'd never taught me at Andover or Yale. I'd read something and I'd say, wait a minute.
Right.
I took AP history. How come I never knew about that? Close quote. Explain.
Well, I think it's true. I think when I was in... when I was in high school, which is during the McKinley administration, everyone was obsessed with nuclear Armageddon.
That's an old joke for the kids who don't know who McKinley is.
No. Well, I will not stoop. I'm not going to dumb it down, Harry. They can Google it while they're on the thing.
They're on like.
And everything I learned was that Reagan was going to blow up the world. He was insane. And we're going to have a nuclear Armageddon. That was the cultural... zeitgeist at the time, ABC, whatever network had the day after. It was all about like terrible, terrible Cold Warrior Ronald Reagan.
Wait a minute. ABC was whatever being shown at Yale?
No.
Okay, but I thought this was an intellectual history.
Yeah, that's right. But that was pretty much what we all talked about.
Yeah, go right ahead. Go right ahead.
No problem.
There's no extra for you.
Somebody's got to listen to this.
And then that didn't happen. Then the Soviet Union collapsed. And all the
wait. Did you fact check other ABC movies? As
no,
well,
I don't know if it was ABC. Happened? Now you're just being semantic here. All I'm trying to say is that I was told that the Soviet Union was
stuff
powerful.
That you saw on TV yeah. didn't turn out to be true, yeah. and this is the reason you're a conservative.
Exactly right.
This is pretty sad intellectual history. If
well, that's all I got.
Okay,
and that's what that was the beginning. The right. irony is the person who gave me the book Modern Times to read was Fareed Zakaria, who's now. A moderate, I'd say.
Okay, so let me ask, during the Reagan years, where were you politically, Harry?
I was critical.
Critical of Reagan.
Yeah, I mean, I do political humor on radio. It's my job to be critical of the European construct would be the people who have the monopoly of the guns in this country. You have to say the people who have the majority of the guns, which is the government at this point, I think.
Unfortunately.
So whoever, has that role, my job is, and I relish that job, of finding what's wrong with the people who are running the place.
Okay, now we go to a clip from this is now
whiplash time.
This is the intellectual, right. the intellectual history of Harry Shearer. We go to a clip of the
can
big...
Can I just go stand outside while you're doing this?
Stop that.
Working on your tan?
Well, I just...
Hold on. Could you do a Benny for me? Now cut that out! Right. The big uneasy. We now go to a clip of Mr. Shearer's The Big Uneasy, his 2010 documentary on New Orleans and Hurricane Katrina.
Not on Hurricane Katrina.
On the after effect?
On the cause of the flooding.
This is important. Yeah,
on important. The cause of the flooding.
Which was not Hurricane Katrina. That's the point of the movie.
Okay. Clip and then...
The other thing Katrina taught the nation was a need to go back in and look at the levees. See if they still met the capacity that they were designed for and were they being maintained.
According to the Corps of Engineers, around the country there are more than 100 cities that have levees which may not be protecting them as well as they think. Hello, Sacramento.
Okay, so...
Now, she is Karen Durham Aguilera, who at the time was the head of task... You're going to like this verbiage, Task Force Hope, which was the
OTFOH.
Yeah, the part of the Army Corps of Engineers, which was doing the building of the new $14 billion you paid for it system that is currently protecting New Orleans, and she's defending. She's in the film to defend against the charges, the findings of two independent teams of investigators, one based at UC Berkeley, one based at LSU, which found. That the flooding in 2005 was caused not by a humongous hurricane overtopping perfectly mm-hmm. fine levees, but a series of catastrophic failures, misjudgments, bad decisions, even against internal advice to the contrary, by the Army Corps of Engineers. And the movie is among other things, a document about this rogue agency, why it exists the way it does and how it gets away with this stuff over and over again.
Okay, so brilliant documentary, which is, as far as I can tell, first of all, it's just mesmerizing. You're good at putting together film. You don't need me to say this, but it's just mesmerizing.
No, I have to say this also. If you ever wanted to understand what happened,
it's the best.
It's the best, clearest version of it. In many ways, it's Katrina. I know, but it's Katrina for dummies. It's New Orleans for dummies. You look at it and you get how it all.
And the dummies, by the way, are the people in the national media who still have not told this story.
That's true.
So Harry, here's my question. I look at that and I say, what Harry is sort of casually more liberal than conservative, but he's in love with New Orleans. He discovers this story that the government agency, the Army Corps of Engineers, just not only did it not do its job, but it lulled people into a sense of security.
And as its punishment, it got $14 billion and got told to do it again.
Right. So why aren't you... Why isn't there a specific political effect of your of the rage you feel at what took place? Why aren't you a hard libertarian by now?
Because we're sitting here at a time when, in London, where I'm about to fly, a private firm called G4S, which was given the job of doing security at the London Olympics, has had to admit within 2 weeks of the opening of the London Olympics that it has not been able to provide the number of security personnel it guaranteed to provide. Nor can it assure the operators of the Olympics that the people it has trained and hired will show up.
Well, that's now, different.
No. I'm speaking to your point.
Right.
The as he testified today before Parliament, he could not disagree with the characterization of his firm's performance as a humiliating shambles. Now, why wouldn't that force somebody to believe that the privatizing of work for the public sector is a hideously bad idea? You could ask the same question.
Here's the argument for you to make to your friend Harry. You say to Harry, Harry, I'm sorry.
Well, that won't happen.
that's not going to happen. I know him well.
Already you're wrong.
Yeah. It may be satisfying. It may feel good to rage against government and private sector alike and say, oh, what fools.
And by
we're
the way,
all fools. We're all poltroons. But really, politics matters, and you need to make decisions. You've got to say, on balance, the private sector is more reliable, more efficient, right?
Well, what I would say is I can't speak to the security issue in London, but I can say that around the world there are South Korean and there are Dutch companies that are private that manage to do a pretty good job of building and maintaining levees and building and maintaining safe waterways. So the examples exist.
Well, you said to me when we were talking about The Big Uneasy a while ago, Harry's documentary, you said, at some level, Harry must understand that if all those levees were in private hands, that town would never have flooded.
I agree.
Now, here's the thing. The story confounds these distinctions because the Corps of Engineers, as we document in the film, was hollowed out during the Reagan administration for reasons that have more to do with the procurement reform than anything else. And they decided to privatize most of the operations. As Dr. Bob B., whose dad spent his life in the Corps. He spent his early career in the Corps and now goes around the world and does postmortems on disasters, says the Corps of Engineers is now the Corps of Contract Administrators. So all the work, the actual work, is done by private contractors. Now, they do well, they do badly, they do in between. It is a fact that in the mid-1990s, one of the private contractors said to the Corps, your contract calls for us to put a foundation under this wall that is not sufficiently deep. We're not hitting solid ground here. We want to build a deeper foundation. The Corps took them to court, and the court found for the Corps, yes, your contract requires you only to build 17 feet deep. The contractor did as he was ordered to do, and that's one of the walls that failed. Now, I don't know how you parse out.
So it's Ronald Reagan's fault, Rob.
No, when you do that, You're missing the story.
Look, whenever you have a giant federal agency that has procurement, you have procurement.
You mean like the DOD?
Like the DOD. You have gigantic fraud, right? And overruns, and you have some version of Halliburton, all right? For better or for worse, some version of that. Some version of military
contractors. But Halliburton's a good thing, right?
Well, military contractors overspending. But I think in this case, this would have been a perfect example for federalism, where the local. The state should have been able to shop for the best.
With what funds?
I'm not saying it shouldn't be federal funds.
Ah.
But what I'm arguing with is the people that you argue with, the people who should be defending those levies and maintaining those levies.
If this gets too heated, we'll bring in the dogs.
No, look, I agree with Rob. I think the model for the way this stuff should be done is the interstate highway system. Federal funds and states get to do it the way they want. I think had Louisiana not been forced by congressional law passed under Johnson in the wake of Hurricane Betsy to take this, take the favors of the Corps of Engineers to build, as Congress said, a system that would protect New Orleans against the maximum probable hurricane, a definition which the Corps redefined downward at the very beginning of the project to the standard project hurricane, throwing out the most recent serious hurricanes as improbable outliers, Louisiana might have been better.
But let's be honest, the Corps of Engineers right now, and has been since they built the St. Louis Waterway, right? The Corps of Engineers is simply Congress's own private construction company.
That's correct.
And all they do is Congress will get to say, well, build something in my district, build something in my district. It's all it exists for. So it is a box of Legos for Congress, for congressional pork barrel spending.
Segment three.
And you get disasters when that happens.
Segment three. I refer, your final argument lies in the big uneasy.
Yeah.
Yes.
Segment three.
Company. Which don't say lies.
Big invests in, appears in.
Which, by the way, you can download, you can stream on Netflix, right? Netflix.
That's correct.
iTunes,
right.
And on yes. iTunes. Yes. It's fascinating. If you are a conservative, you will cheer.
Yes, actually, you will.
Bad news.
Segment three, company town. 1992 poll showed that in a year in which Bill Clinton carried the country by 43%, the proportion of film and television writers, directors, and producers who voted for Bill Clinton was 83%. 20 years later?
Is this going to be this conservatives can't get a job in Hollywood?
No, well, he's employed.
That, yeah.
No, it isn't. It isn't going to be that.
Because are we through with that yet? That, oh, the poor conservatives can't get a job. You know this poor victimization of conservatives in Hollywood, self-victimization is
20
a
years
crock,
later,
right?
Are you, 20
am I correct?
Later, 20 years, I'm not asking, yo! I'm not going to ask. Yeah, let the man finish.
Yeah, okay.
20 years later, 2012, yeah. So far, by the best numbers I could find Googling around, Barack Obama has raised at least five times as much money out of this town as has Mitt Romney. So the question is, Hollywood is trying to sell products to the rest of America. Hollywood is politically out of sync with the rest of America. I'm not saying, why can't conservatives get jobs? Rob has a job. Vince Vaughn has a job.
Yeah.
The question is,
I know, go figure.
Why is Hollywood, here's the country, here's Hollywood, well to the left of its market. How come?
You're saying that every business should be politically attuned to its market, so I shouldn't get a loan from a bank because ... And by the way, who was the biggest contributor in dollar terms to Barack Obama in 2008? Goldman Sachs.
So, well, I'll do that show in New York.
Okay.
How come? What are you guys doing? Spending money, giving money to the guy who's trying to choke you?
No, I'm just saying that, you know, big cities are never.
Urban.
I don't care what country you live in.
Right.
Big cities are never in sync with the countryside. New Orleans is way out of sync with the rest of Louisiana. London is.
Did Bobby Jindal carry New Orleans?
No.
Governor General?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think
because
so.
Because, when he won re-election with close to 70%
well,
of the vote.
Well, the re-election, he had no, there was Democrats. The Democratic Party is more abundant in Louisiana. I don't think there was, they could have run a Catahoula Blue and gotten more votes.
Hollywood is a Democratic town just because it's one more big city.
No, I think Hollywood's a Democratic town because that's just the prevailing nature of the people who work here. And I think
San Francisco is more liberal than Los Angeles.
I think
because the point is that Hollywood is producing a product that has content.
But if you look at the Hollywood product now, I'll take the basic assumption of your question. When you look at the Hollywood product,
thank you.
Now,
what a relief! One man takes the.
But if you look at with feature films. I mean, what is it? Disney's going to release 10 movies this year, down from at 1.60. Paramount's going to release maybe 8 movies this year, and the movies they're going to release are large. Big budget comedies with stars, which have really very little political content. They play very well. Or big budget, big feature CGI feature films that
thrillers and superhero movies.
Right, which are apolitical, at least.
Effectively amusement park rides.
Well, yeah but they're not apolitical. I think there was a moment in time when you started hearing political leaders in this country use a phrase that growing up, I thought had been relegated to the trash bin of B-movies when they started referring to the bad guys. And what Hollywood produces now, in many ways, reifies the sense of the world as black and white. There are good guys and bad guys.
Yeah, but the bad guys are all aliens, Harry. They're not bad guys. In old Hollywood, the bad guys were Indians and bad and robbers. And actual bank
and
robbers
Italians.
And Italians, right? Now, like, they're, you can't now, have a, you could not have a bad guy be an actual
have a,
human being.
You they can have an say, Arab.
Where? What is the movie where the Arabs are bad guys?
But there, I don't
20
see
years
movies.
Ago.
20 years ago.
Maybe 20 years
ago. Well, that's when the Arabs since... were, that's when the Arabs were bad.
Well, that, yeah, that was before 9/11,
that's right?
Okay, so let me try the question.
9/11 was their shining moment.
Yes. Harry, you grew up in this town.
Yes.
So when you were a little boy,
yeah.
This town was putting out movies like It's a Wonderful Life.
Great Train Robbery.
I was...
The Great Train Robbery. The Gold Rush.
No, no.
I knew
no.
you were going to do
it. No.
The one with the moon.
Yeah, the one with the moon. The nude guy walking. Isn't that your...
Yeah.
Mr. Benny?
Yes.
Now cut that.
Yes. All right. Now cut that. Go ahead. So,
let's take one movie in particular, The Best Years of Our Lives,
yeah.
Which is 1946 or 47? 46. 1946.
Lee Wiley.
And there you have this town producing a movie which is complicated. It talks about the difficulties that soldiers have when they're returning to the United States. But I don't believe there's any way of viewing that movie and concluding that it is anything other than fundamentally celebratory of American life. Right?
Right. And the only one kind of quasi-villain in that movie is a John Bircher.
Okay. So you have two things going on. One is...
There was a John Bircher in 1946?
I think that's...
One is certain level of complexity. That is a film that really does rise, I would argue, to the level of art.
Yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh. Right?
It's a great movie.
And then the second point is you've got the notion that the town that produced that magnificent movie is fundamentally affirming of America. And neither is true of the product of Hollywood anymore. What happened?
Well, you had a generation of people running Hollywood at the time who were immigrants, mainly, who were very grateful at bottom for the fact that they were not back where their relatives were being incinerated. So they felt...
Largely Eastern European Jewish.
That's correct.
Right.
That's what I mean. So there was an underlying level of gratitude for a haven, an imperfect haven. We remember the ships that turned Jews back, but a haven nonetheless. You can't replicate that generation after generation, you know, in the same way that people who come up poor... And achieve some wealth, complain that their kids don't, you know, take stuff for granted that they never did. Mm. You have a generation of people running Hollywood now who take
but Harry,
stuff
isn't that,
for granted.
Isn't that sheer callousness?
No, it's human nature.
If you're a big time,
it's human nature.
You have the money. You take your children to India for vacation because you're so rich. You certainly have a place on Cabo San Lucas down in Mexico. You step off Cabo San Lucas, a little American island. It's very easy to say that the United States of America is still a miracle, isn't it?
Well, it's not a miracle. Finland is a, you know, if you look at the list.
Finland's a miracle?
Finland's a miracle.
Finland's a miracle.
If you look at no, Peter.
Yeah, yeah.
Seriously,
what I have to put up with.
One of the things I do on my radio show is do a running tally of where we're not number one. And, you know, people who I think share your and Rob's beliefs, you know, would believe that this is a country where, oh, my God, we have stuff that nobody else has. Well, the fact is the list, and I'm not trying to recapitulate the horrible opening speech from the newsroom, but the list.
And yet I'm about to do it.
The list of things in which America is not number one is pretty shocking at this point in time.
And yet the health or the stature of a country can be judged by how many people want in versus how many people want out.
Right.
More people want in than want out every year, consistently every year. More people want to become
more
Americans.
More people want to
than want to become
get into Britain than want to get out. I mean, there are a lot of countries of which that can be said. We're not the only one.
Well, I don't think anybody said we're the only one.
Well, that's what Peter was suggesting.
We represent...
American exceptionalism is a claim that we're the only one.
No. This claim we're the only one. It's just that we are the last best hope for freedom and liberty and peace on Earth.
And Harry is saying that in 1946, you could say that with a straight face. You could use Lincoln's phrase, the last best hope. It still resonated, but not no longer.
Well, you know, America...
Just a pretty good deal, not the last best hope. Is that right?
America's most recent wars have not been nearly as satisfying and vindicating as the war we had just been in 1946.
No, that's very true. Or as imperiling, or as...
So what's your position? America's a pretty good deal, or it's still the last best hope?
Well, it's still the last best hope. Without a doubt.
On account of?
On account of our incredibly vibrant economy, even when it's slow. Our credible opportunity that people from working poor and middle class have to get rich.
The degree of social mobility in this country has gone down drastically over the last 30 to 40 years. We are maybe 15th or 16th in the world in social mobility at this point.
What do you mean by social mobility?
The ability to rise from one class to another.
No, that's only defined if you look at the gap, income gap, which is, of course, completely fraudulent. The truth is that there's the largest increase in middle class wealth started with Reagan and continues. Now, it's been dipping the past couple of years because we had an economy tanked, but if you are a free agent poor person, with an ability to get to any country in the world, the country you want to come to that has the most opportunities in the United States. That is statistically true.
Well, cite the statistic.
Boys.
Immigration.
We will have a bright young intern. If you have statistics as you used on your radio show, this is the kind of thing where you move the discussion onto the web.
Yeah, you know, I read stuff.
Okay, fine.
We'll point people to the web like CNN does. Full coverage of this story, go to our website. We're only here to sell you pills
and gold.
Gold. Hey, who do you buy your gold from, Peter? I trust G. Gordon Liddy. What about you?
Well, first I deal with my psoriasis.
Yeah.
May we have a word or two from Mr. Burns? And I'm going someplace with this.
You can't afford, Mr. Burns.
Mr.
Yes.
Mr. Burns, are you happy to be among the 1%?
I'm happy to be among the 0.0001%. What about you? Where do you fit?
All right. So
you are going to get so sued for this.
Really?
Oh, I'm going to make a call.
You've said a couple of things about Mr. Burns. One is that you've modeled him on a couple of people. Lionel Barrymore.
I did not say that.
You didn't?
No.
I found it in quotation marks. I was Googling
really?
Around. Yes.
You mean people put things in quotation marks that people haven't said?
Yes.
I am shocked.
Well, who did you model it on then?
I didn't model it on anybody.
I read that you said it was part Lionel Barrymore and part Ronald Reagan.
No, I said looking back at it, you could sort of hear those things in
Oh, but it wasn't conscious on your part?
No. I do very little that's conscious when I'm doing comedy.
That's for sure.
No, I mean, seriously.
Successful.
I didn't.
All right.
I'm kidding.
So there's no... There's
I'm just
no,
going to keep doing this.
No,
yeah, I know. This is not for the blind. This is for the... thinking impaired.
Thinking impaired, right.
There was no calculation of I'm going to make it sound like this. I just made a noise, and I thought, you know,
just now or
oh, always.
Okay,
in this segment, in case you haven't cottoned onto it yet, and I'm trying to move it toward a theme.
Okay.
I'd actually like to discuss both of you, your current work, a little bit,
okay,
and how it bears. It
I'd love to hear about Rob's both. Work because
this happens so rarely.
Yeah, right.
You're giving him time to think of it.
Yeah.
So, The Simpsons.
Yeah.
22 years.
We're in season 24.
Season 24.
Good research.
So, well, that was right along with the material I found in quotation.
To be fair, the last 2 years haven't been funny. So he's
No. These are the statistics that'll be on the internet.
On the internet, yeah. Right?
Okay. So the notion here is: here's my little theory of The Simpsons,
yep.
Which I confess I haven't had time to watch the way I did when I was still in school, but I adored The Simpsons then.
It was good then.
So the theory is that this. Homer is a blue-collar chump, but he loves his wife. They live in suburbia. They have an intact nuclear family.
They go to church.
They go to church. They take seriously taking care of Grandpa Simpson. They keep in touch with Marge's sort of.
He's in a home.
In other words,
nice home.
Yeah.
The Simpsons is popular because as smart-alecky as it is, as wonderfully sharp and edgy, and it's still fundamentally celebratory of American life.
You're saying that or you're asking me?
I'm asking. Do you think what is the secret to The Simpsons? ?
Well, you know,
am I onto something?
Let me answer you this way. In season one, The Simpsons was a target for a great wave of criticism, largely from the at least partially from the evangelical Christian right, because Bart was a bad role model, and this was a bad kind of thing to be showing people, as if people in comedy shows are ever good role models.
Right.
Certain logical problem there. By season 15, I was doing interviews with Christian Century about the fact that I play Reverend Lovejoy and Ned Flanders,
right.
Only two avowedly, clearly Christian, church-going, one church-leading characters on American television. In a way, both were true. It took 15 years for the blind people to discover the size of the entire elephant. The show is socially subversive, and it is also celebrative. It's both. That's why it's a hit. If it were one or the other, I don't think it would reach a mass audience. You have to do a couple of things to reach a mass audience. You have to be working on a couple of wavelengths, not just one, I think.
Yes?
I also think the culture changed a little bit. I mean, the idea of that, like, it's been on for a long time, and the culture changed so much that if you are evangelical Christian, like, well, at least they go to church in 2012. Look, that's better than anything else we got.
Well, excuse me, but in 1990, there were no church-going families on television either. I mean, whatever you think, The Simpsons.
It's such a drought, though. I mean, I certainly think that's the only comedy. I mean, there was Touched by an Angel. There are a few other shows that are religious.
You're right.
The only comedy where you sort of take as your assumption the families go to church, and there's nothing wrong with making fun of a preacher. There's nothing wrong with making fun of your hyper-religious neighbor. That's perfectly normal. That's perfectly acceptable in a comedy. I mean, I used to get that all the time. I mean, when I started in 1990, and we were working on a show where people drank,
Cheers.
And now you're doing a show about beer. Is that a theme in your career?
Completely, yeah. Here's the difference. Yeah. Is that when we started, all of the pressure was don't be vulgar. Like, there were a certain number of times you could say bastard. You
know, this is 1988.
This is 1990.
But that's network television.
And that was broadcast, right. Yeah. Broadcast network television. But now the argument is simply what you can't say. You can be as vulgar as you like, really, on broadcast. I mean, there's nothing. I don't do anything.
Because you moved to cable.
I don't do anything on ad-supported cable on TBS. Very funny. That they aren't doing more of on CBS on Two and a Half Men. But the political correctness and the care with which all the dialogue is parsed and thought about is so extraordinary.
I want to pick up on this because in 1973, 1974, 1975, I was on the radio with a comedy group, and when we made fun of racists, we could have the characters talk the way racists talk. Mm-hmm. But I got fired for saying the word penis. Now, Howard Stern makes $500 million a year for saying penis, but you can't have racists talk the way racists talk. This led me to the belief that there is
That word, or were there words before it and after it?
Just that word. That there is a third Newtonian or fourth Newtonian law, the law of conservation of taboo. And taboo moves. And as the culture changes, right, there is a given amount of taboo in a culture, but it moves to kind of alive with
so
the
Sullivan and Son. Sullivan and Son, I haven't seen yet because
there'll be millions. We'll see it.
As we shoot this show, the premiere is 48 hours away, 2 days away. But I gather from emails that you and I have exchanged and so forth that that at TBS you feel out from under the overhang of political correctness.
Well, in the market of today, but I mean to use sort of Harry's parameter of starting in the early 70s. In the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, you had race riots in the streets. You had
Where do you want your race riots?
Exactly. You had a racial terrorism, Black Panthers. You had an enormous sort of violent culture fighting race wars, and you had
that's a bit of an over.
Well, not really. It's four, so I don't know. And you had television with a racist. Archie Bunker was one of the most popular shows on television. Talking the way a racist talks.
We had characters talking more blatantly.
Okay, but I mean,
radio.
But it was still incendiary.
Yeah.
But it managed. But the culture could handle that. Whereas now we actually have an African American president, and
half
up till now
half African
half yeah okay African American president, and we can't. There's a whole range of things you can't talk about on television.
Right. Okay.
So we've come far in the culture, but my ability to write dialogue. I mean, you could not write an Archie Bunker character today.
But you can say a lot of raunchier stuff.
But
that's my point. The taboo just moves. It, we still have it.
Okay, so segment five, our last segment here, changes.
Wow. Is this the last one already?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, man, time.
You know, I actually, if you could get a shot, I actually probably have a parking ticket, but that's, well.
I got a plane to catch. I don't know about you. What time do you have?
You're all right.
I'm all right.
Thank you. Thank you for your time, John.
My pleasure.
Well, yeah.
It seems like it
didn't fly.
Rob is not that old, although he's got
the
Mitt Romney gray. Mitt Romney gray temple.
Compared to petroglyphs,
when the earth was lava. Yeah.
And when he started, in this, it was three major networks.
Yeah,
and
before.
Then, and, well,
FBC. When I started, sure.
It wasn't major then. It was still UHF.
Yeah, that's right.
Fine. So 3.5 major networks.
Yeah.
Cable TV, internet. What difference to the product of this town are these technological changes? Budgets are down.
The more buyers you have, the more channels there are, the fewer people are watching any given channel. Therefore, the less money there is to spend on any given half hour of programming. Therefore, cheaper programming starts taking over. On cable, it's cheaper to have a guy from the left and a guy from the right yelling about the news than to go cover the news. On primetime entertainment, it's cheaper to have a couple of guys with, cameras shoot some real people who know they're supposed to act like fools than to pay for really overpriced writers and actors to perform scripted shows. This is the pervasive influence of the multi-channel universe. Cheap.
Well, I'm not sure about that. I would say, yes, lower cost probably, or more cost conscious, but I would say by any definition, this is the golden age of television. There's more good TV on right now on a whole variety of channels and outlets that has ever been before. So
because talented kids can come here.
Talented kids. And also, look, when I started, I've been canceled for getting a 14 or 15 share, meaning 15% of all TVs were tuned into my channel.
He'd be getting a bonus for that now.
Wouldn't be here.
He'd be king of Hollywood.
I'd be in a chateau, right? And that was as recently as 2000. So when the audience sort of atomizes a little bit, it's enormous. This is a great time to get into the business if you're young and you can sort of survive for a while.
But if you already have a mortgage, it's a hard time.
If you have a mortgage and kids in school, you're kind of...
On the other hand, Rob is a little rosy-hued when he says that. And I'll tell a little story to amplify my point. There's a wonderful British comedy series of a few years back called Father Ted, which
I think I remember. Yeah,
which was about a group of Catholic priests at a small church in rural Western Ireland.
Right,
very
right,
funny. And my partner in the show, I'm doing the Nixon show now.
In London,
was the executive producer of that show. And at a certain point, he sold the format rights to NBC. And the very first question that NBC people asked him when they had a first meeting is, do the priests have to be Catholic?
Well, they only,
golden age, some golden age.
But broadcast television is always making those mistakes. But if the preponderance of television right now that's good and quality is great. It's great. It's a great time.
So let me try.
Just don't get paid. There's no big fat giant paycheck at the end for anything less than a mega hit. Whereas there used to be. There used to be, you did 5 years of an okay sitcom. You didn't really ever break out into the top 10. Maybe you were in the bottom 20.
And you could live like a Rob Long.
But it would be sold at a syndication. You make $50 million.
So we now look back on the Beverly Hillbillies as unwatchable. How could this town, how could talented people have associated themselves with that kind of
I thought clap, that clap, at the laughter? Time.
You thought it at the time.
Yeah.
A lot of people thought it at the time. CBS thought that at the time. And CBS did
but the
a,
people,
did
the
a
writer,
turn.
The writers who turned out that formulaic.
Funny.
But the writers did very well. Everybody involved with that show made a lot of money.
That was CBS's attempt to, going back to an earlier thought of yours, to appeal to the middle of America, and not appeal to the folks in New York and Los Angeles.
They found they weren't making enough money, so then they made a hard turn in another direction with Mary Tyler Moore and Bob Newhart, and also those were the golden age. I think in terms of financially, the golden age for those gigantic pots of money were the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And all those people who had hit TV shows on did really, really well. I mean, what's also happened is the advertising
market. So please send some money to Rob.
Oh, yeah.
What's
also happened is the advertising market, which is that right now, it used to be, if you were running a business and you walked down the hallways of your business, I've said this to you many times, and your employees were watching TV or reading magazines, you'd think, hey, everybody, turn off the TV, get back to work. You when you were at work for 8 hours a day, 9 to 5, you were absolutely unreachable to advertisers. They couldn't get to you. You were sitting in a desk. You were doing your work. Now you have a computer on. The computer's got ads. You have your phone on. Your phone's got ads. People are basically surfing the web for hours a day at work. Even Gmail has ads embedded in it. So now there's suddenly 8 more hours of inventory, of advertising inventory you can sell. So supply goes up, demand goes down, prices go down. So everything's getting squeezed. And so people who are super talented, I mean, like Louis C.K.
He's sounding like Jim Cramer all of a sudden.
Well, but it's true. It's true. People who are super talented right now, you can do some great stuff. And you may not need to go sit at the development office at NBC. You don't need their eyeballs, which go down every year. You could get great eyeballs and get very, very well paid on FX or TBS or anywhere.
As a consumer, is it correct? I'm just talking as a layman who likes movies and television. So would it be correct to say, don't expect any more of the best years of our lives, where major motion pictures are rise to the level of art? Those have to be inoffensive. They have to command a gigantic audience. They will be, in effect, thrillers, computer-generated graphics.
I think if you're talking about major studio product, pretty much yes.
Okay, I agree.
There's still a little pipeline. It shrinks, and sometimes it gets a little bigger for independent specialty films, which can rise to the level of art. I've been told about a film. I don't want to mention it by name. I haven't seen it yet, but friends have raved about it. And then I've heard some contrary opinion that's out right now that if you listen to the Believers, rises to that level of art. Okay. But it's a little independent film made on a shoestring.
That's where we have to look for our artistic or intellectual satisfaction.
And just even technology and distribution. I mean, we started talking about Harry's Movie. Harry's Movie is available to anybody.
The Big Uneasy.
From Netflix.
Right.
Or from iTunes. You can stream it.
Or from Amazon.
Or from Amazon. So it's available. He didn't have to go. He didn't find a distributor for it. And I would say that 10 years before,
you didn't
or
have
20
to go
years before.
At studios.
I didn't bother with studios, but I did go to a small independent distributor that specialized in documentary films to get it into theaters. Because you have to get, it's great, as Rob is indicating, to have all these platforms. But people still have to know that your movie exists.
You're still marketing.
And
that's still a problem.
When the national media ignored not only the movie, but the story behind the movie, I didn't care if they didn't mention me or the movie, but I made the movie to get the story out. It was important for people to understand this was not a natural disaster. This was not something that just affected poor black people. It affected 80% of a metropolitan area, all that stuff that the media got wrong. For people to know that this movie exists, I had to go on the road last year for half the year and be with the movie as it opened in city after city to get local press attention, which is what, you know, gave it a bit of notoriety so that people could know it existed so they could go find it at Netflix. So they're still, the big guys still control the distribution pipelines most of the time.
But less and less every year.
Yeah.
If you were both 20...
And when I mean big guys, I don't mean, you know, like no, him, but I no, mean...
No. Well, if you were both, carbs, let's be honest.
If you were both 25 years old...
Which is not that far away for me, but for you, that's...
If you were both 25 years old, would you have rather...
Work done.
Would you have rather...
Look at this stuff,
I like to put that in.
That's his little... It's called gravitas. That's his implicit support for Mitt Romney.
Gravitas is like a Grecian formula, right?
It is exactly what it is. In reverse.
Now,
cut that out.
Gravitas. Yeah.
If you were 25, would you have rather come into this town in 1947, 1987 when Rob did, or today?
I loved this town when I was a kid growing up in it. I thought that... And
40s, 50s, 60s.
Yeah. Working for Jack Benny, there were four writers. The show assumed that, you know, we're here to do a comedy show. We're going to make people laugh. We know what we're doing. Let's do our job and go home. Flash forward to a sitcom I was working on in the 70s where people stayed up until 2 in the morning to decide, you know, does Squiggy steal the dresses in scene B or scene C?
I wonder what show that was.
I mean... The degree to which comedy turned into an operatic art form backstage is just stupefying. And compared to when I came up, when you just did your job, you were assumed to be a professional. Everybody knew what they were doing. Let's have fun. Let's go home. It's just amazing.
Every conversation with the network executive now begins with, and I'm really not kidding. This is not an exaggeration. But almost every note session after a run-through or a reading begins with, it's really funny.
But
it's like, and I always think, but what? I mean, that's we're doing a comedy show here. Like,
job done.
Right. It's really funny, but.
Yeah. Now, just as a contrast, the pilot that I did for this show in England, which I mentioned.
Nixon's the one.
Showed it to the network chief there, had seen it, called us in for a meeting. He said, you know, I like the character.
The character of Nixon, the way
you've done it, and I like the way you've done the show.
Only America thought that.
And I'm hearing but, and his follow up was, so how many more do you want to do?
Wow.
Yeah. Different country. Different system.
Which,
and,
by the way,
different price point.
You've touched. Yeah. I've got a couple of. I posted on Ricochet.
Not for me.
No, no, I know you don't bust your quote. Yeah. This guy.
Question. A couple of questions from Ricochet members. Casey Mulville, quote: could Jack Benny have made it in today's comedy world?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Benny was a reactor. That is to say, he loved for his other people in his ensemble to get laughs because he could always get a topper laugh by just reacting.
One eyebrow.
Yeah. So, on the other hand, he worked at a much different pace than is ambient today. And whether somebody working at that pace could make it in the comedy business, I don't know. I mean, I work at a different pace than
you mean his professional pace or his pace on stage? Everything.
The pace of his work on stage, on screen. It was a, you know, he was of another time. So when you try to imagine transplanting that, the first thing you think of is, oh my God, everything is frantic in pace by comparison to him. He couldn't possibly just be airdropped down in this moment and work as he did, but he's a good enough talent and craftsman. He probably would have figured out, I got to work faster.
There's an old story Bob Newhart told me that because Newhart had very similar Benny rhythms. Very similar Benny rhythms.
No kidding.
Yeah, because you did. I guessed it
on a show that Rob produced with Newhart, and I thought, not since Benny have I.
You
seen
actually
it.
Pulled me aside. And said, that's like Benny.
Yeah.
And Newhart has that, and I think he was, he might have been at home or something, and or maybe it was after a table reading, and some executive said, it's a little long. I mean, we could maybe if you could just talk faster. And Newhart said, I don't talk faster. This is what I do. And like, and when you write a script for Newhart, it was always 30 something pages because he was going to get laughs just with a look because you knew his character and you knew how, and he took his time on lines and he just knew intuitively that you take a little extra time, you get a bigger laugh. It's all it is you're just winding it up a little tighter. Whereas now this desperation.
You're both sounding elegiac. You don't want to do that. What do you most like about the current environment?
Freedom. Look, I think I think if you watch on FX,
he's so pandering to you now.
But it's true. Louis C.K. You look at Louis C.K. Like he made a deal at FX to do a show. Now he's already had a show on HBO. Didn't do very well. And he asked FX, what's the most amount of money you'll give me to do a TV show and stay out of my hair? And they said something like $800,000. He said, fine. So he makes a TV show for $800,000 an episode. He cuts it himself on his MacBook Pro. So he edits it himself. He buys the camera. He runs the whole budget. He has $800,000 to spend all in. The show is fantastic. Probably the best episode of television the past year was his, which was, it's a 1 hour where he goes to Afghanistan to perform for the troops. His daughter sneaks a little duckling, a live duckling in, which sounds weirdly treacly, but it is absolutely magnificent. And he did it and turned it in. Said, here's my episode. So people who can do that, who are immensely talented, that's the best thing. So I actually think if Jack Benny came back here, he would build a big audience, not even making an adjustment, because it's still funny. Funny didn't change. Funny, it's still funny.
Okay, last question. What do you most admire about Harry?
Uh-oh. My wife.
You are friends.
Yeah, that's true, actually. this baffling relationship. This is true now. A true perfectionist, unwilling to compromise on things that he knows are true, willingness to sort of, the only power you have in Hollywood is the willingness to say no and walk away, which he has. And then a genuine sense of humor about everything.
Oh, good Lord. I feel like I've died and I'm listening in on my funeral.
Well, see, here's the difference. I won't come to your funeral.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. I won't die.
Well,
there, deal.
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah. Then, yeah. All right.
What do you most admire about Rob?
I got to go. I'm late for
you
a plane.
You have a plane. That's right.
Rob Long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rob Reiner.
Yeah. What? Either one? Can I choose?
Choose.
Rob.
Choose.
Rob. No.
I was serious.
I know you were.
Yeah. I should have. I should go second.
I'm going to go the other way.
Okay, good.
Yeah. No, I admire Rob's intellect, his ability to staunchly defend what he believes and yet see the logical, wrinkles that might appear in it to a critic and defend against those with gusto.
He likes you because you push back.
His delight in food and his knowledge therein and his ability to do. I'm a cook. Rob is a baker. Which is a whole different branch of the food thing, and he is impeccable as a host.
Dogs, food, and politics.
That's all you need.
That's Harry, life.
Harry Shearer and Rob Long, thank you. For Uncommon Knowledge, I'm Peter Robinson.